Rejection is a funny thing, mostly because we get it entirely wrong in at least two ways. First, we define it wrong. Rejection isn't the act of necessarily inviting retaliation and immediate contempt upon ourselves from others. It's simply the refusal or dismissal of an idea or a question. And when put that way, it doesn't sound quite so loaded. And in fact, it sounds downright weatherable. But that leads to the other way that we perhaps get it wrong, and that is this. We avoid it. But it's almost natural to want to avoid it. After all, on an MRI, the areas of the brain that become activated when we experience physical pain, too, can be set into action by experiencing the emotions well within the normal range associated with rejection. Indeed, it has a mission, though, in the bioevolutionary sense anyway. That is, for our primitive ancestors, being ostracized from social groups could quite literally mean a death sentence, as we weren't very likely to survive alone for long. One theory among evolutionary psychologists purports our magnificent brains developed something like an early warning system that let us know we were at risk of getting dissed by our community. And those who experienced rejection as more painfully than others gained something like an evolutionary advantage and were perhaps able to get it together and change their ways in time to stay in the group. So if you tend to take rejection particularly hard, know that very quality could have very well saved your life in the time of our earliest human forebears. Yet while our brains perhaps used rejection as an alert so we wouldn't be left alone as saber-toothed tiger food, what if we thought about it in a different way now? What if it could also be a heads up to show us situations and parts of ourselves with which we could do something remarkable? I mean, we all get rejected, and since we aren't really in danger of it killing us like it might have in early human times, why not put it to work a little? Or at least maybe shift it into a place in which we don't try to avoid it quite so hard. But this is not a show about empty platitudes like dusting ourselves off and getting back out there to try again. And it's certainly not about not feeling what we're feeling. But rather, it's a look at how we think and talk about rejection and maybe about how we can use it a little more creatively by, in fact, seeking it out. So tonight, that's what we'll consider: rejection and the interesting twists and turns that can unfold in pursuit of the nope, the nuh-uh, and the no way. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America,
this is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
You heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm very grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. And so tonight on the program, we're going to be talking about a word that many of us dread with very, very good reason, and that is rejection. But we're not going to do some big downer of a show. We're going to go after what we often are going after on this program, and that is a different or more expansive way to perhaps think about a given topic. We're going to look at the idea of not just embracing rejection, but we'll talk with a few people who straight up pursue and invite it. And guess what? It is not killing them. In fact, fascinating things have occurred by, in a sense, preparing their minds for the absolute worst. We're going to be talking with New York Times bestselling author Harlan Coben, who has built a whole career on getting comfortable with being very uncomfortable and helping others do the same. We'll also talk with a professor and co-author of a study about how the language we use helps or hurts our shot at our goals, and with an author who aimed at getting 100 rejection letters. We have a pretty packed show tonight as ever, so I cannot swear that we're going to be able to take too many calls, but 312-981-7200 and esteemed producer Tom Hush will be the first voice on the other end of the line if you would like to call and share a story of your own about rejection. We'll be right back to get the story underway on 720 WGN.
So,
720 WGN. This is Amy Guth, and welcome to the Saturday Night Special. Very glad you're with us this evening. Always grateful to you for your time. As ever, we pick one big old topic and sit around talking about it all night. And as ever, it gets very nuanced and complicated fast, even though it seems pretty straightforward at the top. And tonight's topic is rejection. And I know immediately upon hearing that word, so many people go, ooh, and make this cringe face. I know that happened as I was telling people this week about what the topic was going to be. People would go, oh, really? Oh, that's scary. Indeed, it's very connected to vulnerability and goals and all the things. So joining us tonight is Harlan Cohen. He is a best-selling author of many books that we'll be talking about here in just a bit. But he is someone who has quite literally made a career out of being very comfortable with being uncomfortable, which is not a thing you get to say about a lot of people. Welcome to the show.
So happy to be here. I'm saying happy a lot to counter the word rejection. Just saying, so happy. I am so happy. This is going to be so great. And people are going to feel so good. They're going to feel so amazing.
Here's hoping.
Oh, it's so good. And your introduction on rejection, let me just tell you, was beautiful.
Thank you.
And what struck me as so beautiful about it was that you took this thing that we're so afraid of and you took it down to our primal time and you gave everybody permission to feel it. And what I've seen is most people are so afraid. They're so afraid to feel it. And just feeling it is the first step to finding all that happiness and amazing feelings and all the things we want. And I love it because you made it so accessible. And can I tell you one more thing I love?
Sure, by all means.
I love so many things. I love so much about rejection. But I love that part where our brain actually interprets rejection like physical pain.
Yeah.
So if you were to step over here and hit me.
Which I will not do.
But you might. This is a long hour. We never know. And it's rejection. So things, or Tom, you never know. But if you did, that same pain is the same pain that we feel in our brains. And again, it's this thing of, oh, yeah, this isn't me. This is biological. And if this is biological, then you know, like, I can't fight this thing.
Right.
Like, it's just here. Whoa. I get.
He's so excited. He's knocking water bottles over.
You know what? Here's the deal, Amy. I've been around. And this word rejection, like, I've been obsessed with it for years. And I know most people, it's funny that when you said the word rejection, what the show is, people have this visceral reaction of,
yeah.
Because the word.
It freaks people out. People go out of their way. Right. People do unbelievable things to go out of their way to avoid rejection. They will pine away for a person or a job or a place for decades rather than just say, buy the ticket or do you want to have a drink or whatever the thing is. You'll go out of their way to avoid rejection.
It's so scary. It's so scary. And that was really where it all started with just with me and the writing. And I write an advice column as well. And the thing, you know, I'll tell you, the reason I write advice, I love helping people. Okay. Don't get me wrong. I want to help people, but I'm incredibly selfish. Okay. I want to help myself because I'm neurotic and I'm insecure and I'm uncomfortable. Can I tell you something that happened a couple days ago?
Please do.
So I snore. Okay. And I snore to the point where my wife says, you got to go to a doctor. If you love me, you'll go to a doctor. It's got to happen. If you love me, because your sleep is precious,
sure.
Okay? And you don't want my wife, you know, rejection, relationship rejection, marriage rejection. Marriage doesn't mean it's a ticket to, like, happy land.
Sure.
There's a lot of rejection within that relationship. And my wife said this, and I was embarrassed that I woke her up because I don't want to disrupt her sleep. I want my wife to love me and want me.
Sure.
And snoring is
not hate sleeping near you.
Right. That's not, like, in the bed. It's like you want someone to want you in the bed, not to want you to leave.
Sure.
So anyway, I could talk about this for an hour, just the snoring piece. But anyway, I went to the doctor and they weighed me, and weight's a big issue for me because lately when I'm naked I look in the mirror and I don't go like, yeah, I go ugh. Okay, I'll be honest, it's hard for me to even say. I go like ugh, and I've been working really hard to change this, and I have a plan because I've acknowledged the why am I rejecting myself, what's the self rejection. You know, I actually look in the mirror. And some people can't even look in the mirror. I look in the mirror and I know what's going on and I've faced it and I have a plan. But anyway, I had to go to the doctor and they weighed me and our scale is broken and I weighed myself. And I weighed more than I've weighed probably in 30 years. Okay. I look great. I know. I have a lot of muscle as well. And my waist hasn't gone up as much. But anyway, the doctor weighed me and that was startling and I'm working towards it. But then she had me open my mouth and she looked at my tongue, and she wanted to see my airway. And I said, oh, my tongue's probably a little fat because I've gained some weight. And she said, actually, your tongue looks a little large. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, you could gain weight in your tongue. So I've got a fat tongue.
I feel like there's so many bizarre plastic surgeries out there that every time you think of, you know, you think you've heard it all. I know that will be one at some point.
So here's the deal. Now, I have to face this. Now, the good news is I have a plan, and I can share the plan. Like I face it, and I don't shrivel up in a ball. I get impatient and irritable for one day, and then I have a plan, and my plan is always people, places, and patience, okay? I face the uncomfortable, and instead of beating myself up, I say, hey, dude, you've been through a lot. You've been through a lot of changes. You moved. Lots going on. What is it that you're going to do? And I know how to do this. So who are the people who can help me to really be more of a more responsible eater and really recognize, like, I'm an emotional eater. So who can I talk to and work through that? Where are the places I could go? And I always say you have to have at least three places, places where I can find connection, community, places where I can do the things to change what I want. And how long is it going to take? So I actually have an affirmation that comes up in my phone and it tells me it's December 2017 and you are at a healthy weight. And you look amazing, you feel amazing, and it talks about what I did and how I was able to get there. And that's been the resolution, and I've had a great day today, and yesterday was a great day. And it all started with a fat tongue a few days ago and going to the doctor to realize that I snore and having to face that reality. So, I mean, that doesn't involve anyone else but me, but that is all rejection.
Sure. There's a lot going on there. There's
is that too
there.
Much to like? Did I share too much too soon?
No, it's all good. I'm curious, though, if we back way up from there, though, how did your, because you have said before you are obsessed with rejection. What made you obsessed with rejection?
Right.
What shifted you from, I think we're all kind of socialized early on to not like it.
Right.
And what shifted that for you?
So it was when I was in college, I was really uncomfortable. And I went to one school and I went to UW-Madison. I didn't find my people. I didn't find my places. I transferred. And, you know, going from teen to adult, which is really what college is for so many people, is really the first time you're faced with having to take so many risks. And underlying every risk is the possibility of rejection, no matter how resilient you are. So when starting this new life and really struggling, not able to find my way, I got really depressed. And I typically will eat when I get depressed, and I don't go into rehab. I just eat. And then I ended up transferring from UW-Madison to Indiana. And when I got to Indiana, I was still uncomfortable and it still was hard to find my way. I eventually found my place at the college newspaper, at the Indiana Daily Student. I started writing advice. And I know this started with me saying I write advice. I want to help people. But what the advice column did is it allowed me to get a window into everyone's world. This advice column is called Help Me Harlan. It became really popular on campus. Like, people loved, and there's like 25,000 circulation. And I was writing these responses and people were sending me all these letters. And I realized, oh my gosh, it's not just me. And once I was able to realize it's not just me, I was able to then realize, oh my gosh, what is it that we all struggle with? Whether it's relationships, whether it's romance, whether it's our parents, whether it's our sexual identity. I mean, this is Pride Weekend. I love working with people who have pride and appreciate pride, because to me, it's the ultimate risk to put yourself out there. And if you don't have people, places, and a timeline, it can be devastating. So I saw all these people struggling with all these issues, and it formed this kind of tapestry, and the thread that tied it all together was this fear of rejection. Mm. And then there were episodes throughout my life, from finding my wife, and that's a Chicago story, which I'm happy to share, but that was rooted in, oh my gosh, I am so afraid to take risks. I need to embark on an experiment that's going to help me to meet all of the beautiful people who are walking around the city who I'm so afraid to talk to. And I conducted an experiment that forced me to talk to women at Starbucks at Clark Street near where I lived. And it was awful.
How'd that go?
Oh my gosh. It was so horrible. I got rejected at Lincoln Park Market. I remember it was like New Year's Eve and I had this rule. And I always try to not be creepy, which as a man...
That's a good rule to have.
Here's the deal. And this is for anybody. It's Saturday night, right? Right. I mean, some people are looking for a little love. And here's the reality. If you are not creepy, you can give people permission to think whatever they want. Because as a man who's approaching someone, and a woman approaching someone, anyone who's approaching anyone, there's always this possibility that if I approach you, you might think I'm creepy. But the reality is, Amy, I'm not creepy, or at least not like dangerously creepy, okay?
But do we think people who are creepy think they're creepy?
I think they know. Think they know, unless there's something going on where they can't read the social cues. But I do. I think some people do. This question comes from the advice column of how do I let someone know that I like them without feeling creepy?
Sure.
Okay. Without them thinking I'm creepy. And there was this rule that, and this is a great rule, and I know we're getting into a lot, but this is one of the games that I play that anybody can play. It's you tell yourself your story. And the story is I'm an interesting, creative, loving, dynamic man who wants to invite someone to participate in my life. And the only way I can do that is to talk to you. And if you respond in a way I want, that's wonderful. And if you don't, I give you permission to think whatever you want, acknowledging that I really don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I'm going to give you that. And in a sense, when you look at it, life is more about sending invitations and offering people an opportunity to participate in something great as you trying to get something. And that shift of trying to get something as opposed to offering something changes the whole dynamics of risk-taking, and it doesn't let rejection keep you from following your true feelings.
That is a really interesting shift. I like that, sending invitations rather than pulling for something and trying to kind of pull something in. That's a very interesting shift. See what I said? As ever, we pick this one topic, and as we start to kind of pull at that thread, things begin to unravel, and it becomes a much more complex thing than at first we realized. We are hanging out with Harlan Cohen. He is in studio with us tonight. We're talking all about rejection and the many, many ways we can think about it, we can act around it, we can do something about it, and all of those things, even the way we talk about it. We're going to talk about that a little bit later tonight. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Wise song choice, esteemed producer Tom Hush. Beck's Loser. Nice. Well, the topic tonight is all about rejection. That is the big topic that we're tackling tonight. We have author and advice columnist Harlan Cohen in studio with us to help us do so, because he is, in fact, pretty much obsessed with rejection. He has made a career out of helping people be pretty comfortable with really uncomfortable stuff. And so let's back up to your advice column for a minute, because I'm sure rejection comes up in so many forms, it's unbelievable. But where do you see it the most? I have to believe probably romantic, professional.
Absolutely. I mean, love, dating and relationships. We take all of these classes that help us to get to this next place, but there is not one class on dating and relationships. And, you know, and when I have the time, I want to teach a rejection class. Like, that's one of my goals is, you know, I'm old and I can't travel as much, like super old. I want to do something on that, because there's no dating and relationship course, but yet that's the thing that outlasts our professional careers. Mm-hmm. But yet we're supposed to be able to navigate that. And as we've seen throughout history, it's the one area where some of our greatest, most intelligent leaders seem to trip up on.
Yeah.
Because there is no framework that we introduce. It's just a free-for-all. And then, and you know, with all these things, you get me started. But then we go from high school to college. And, you know, I do a lot of work with college students. And you know, there's alcohol. The way people meet, this is how people learn how to date, okay? It's Saturday night again. If you're in a room long enough, okay, you will hook up, okay? That's how it works. And hooking up can be hand-holding to family planning, okay, whatever that is. So if you're in a room long enough, so if you're trapped in a room wherever you are right now, or if you're trapped in your car with people, you will, if you're trapped for many years, you'll hook up. Even if you're married or in a relationship, time will be like, oh my gosh, we're going to die. It's okay. So if you're trapped long enough, that'll happen. So if you're in a room long enough, you hook up. The other way it works is if you're in a room with alcohol, it happens faster. Well, not a good thing, but you know, that's the reality. And why does that work? Well, because the more people drink, the easier it is to say what they think, the easier it is to act on their feelings. And why? Because their fear of rejection has been suppressed.
Right. Your inhibitions have been dropped.
You know, it's that liquid courage, it's all this thing. Right. But when you get down to it, it's like, you know, why can't I talk to that guy or girl in English class while sober? But if I'm drunk enough and dancing with her, I could be like, yeah, you're that hot one from English. You remember me? Yeah. I wanted to borrow a pencil from you, dude, but you're too hot.
Right.
Let's kiss.
So is it, I mean, I have to think it probably is romantic and professional the most, but I have to also wonder about rejection of the self.
So yes. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Self-rejection there. So let me just take one step back, because to make it really easy, there are five big areas in life where we face big challenges. The acronym is SEPFA, okay?
And it really easy to remember. See,
then it becomes, when we have a career, it becomes SEPFP, okay? So let me break down SEPFA. Okay, so social rejection. This is relationships, friends, family. So first it's social. Next is emotional. And a lot of times emotional, the self-rejection is really grounded in that emotional piece. Social, emotional, physical rejection, physical transitions, financial, and then the last is academic. When we're in school, then it becomes professional. So SEPFA. So, it's so easy
to remember.
Oh, I know, and I'm really hitting the P hard for people. Thank you. I hope we're not modulating with my P. So you look at those five big areas. Okay, so those are the five areas where we have to take risks to get where we want to go, and then how do we navigate those risks? Mm-hmm. How do we overcome the possibility of rejection? And this goes back to, if you want to hit on that, is for everybody who's out there right now, that question, and whenever you're listening, whether you're listening later or in the moment, it's that question of what do you want? You know, what do you want? And I ask people this question all the time. And so many students who I talk to during events, one girl who closed her eyes and tried to do this raised her hand and said, I can't do this. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, everyone's always told me what I should want. Mm. And so that's what we teach kids. What do you want? And this thing of what do you want? What do you want in your social life? What do you want in your emotional life? What do you want physically? I want to be healthy. I want my pants to fit me great. I want to get into some old clothes that I wore 20 years ago. I still have them in there in style, because men, most clothes don't go out of style. But what do you want physically? And then financially, we all have financial goals. I mean, you listen to any infomercial and get Facebook ads popping up in your face every 2 seconds. And what do we want in our professional lives? And the thing is, so many of us are living lives where it's not about what we want, it's what we have to do and take care of. So this idea of giving ourselves the freedom to ask the question, what do I want? And then when we ask that question of what do you want, and I'm going to give you all a place to go, and this is what I do every single day, it's what do you want? And then the next thing is what makes you uncomfortable about that? And you can write it, you can share it with someone who you trust, you can just think it, you could blog it, you could do it on video, but what is it that makes you uncomfortable? Which we're so afraid to talk about because we learn uncomfortable isn't something we celebrate.
And or that it's somehow weird or awkward to talk about what makes you uncomfortable, I think.
Right. And that goes back to even when we grow up. We don't grow up like in a class where embrace uncomfortable. And a lot of times our instructors, our professors, our administrators, they don't want to deal with uncomfortable. I do a lot of work with parents. Parents hate uncomfortable. I've got kids and my kids are uncomfortable. It's the worst.
Sure.
But now I'm like, good. Because you're going to learn, like you have to marinate in uncomfortable a little bit. And I'm not mean like good, but uncomfortable is a good thing. So, okay, to keep this upbeat and happy. So what do you want? I want to find some love. Okay. What makes you uncomfortable? I'm going to get rejected. Well, why? What is it? Because I don't think I'm good enough. Let's just get to it. I'm not good enough. I'm not attractive enough. And I'm too afraid I'm going to get hurt. Awesome. Okay. So then the next thing you think is people, places, patience, the three P's. Who are the people in my corner who I can talk to? If I've got no people, I'm always going to go back with that loser because I don't think anyone's going to want me. So I'm just going to settle for that person. But when you live in a world of options, who are your five people? Who are my five people? You always have people. People who volunteer to help, people who you ask to help, and people you pay to help. So friends, family, professionals. So you think people, places, patience. So who are the people who can help me? Where are the places that I can find connection and community? If you're shy and you don't like rejection, then you know what? Put yourself in rooms where you can do things that you love to do. Because if you're active and you're sweating, or if you're traveling, or if you're in a pottery class, or if you're in a young professional group and you have a leadership role, if you're at work, which most people hook up at work because you're in rooms long enough. So where are the places you could put yourself? And this gets into, I mean, I'm giving so much stuff right now, Amy, but when I think places, it's where can I sweat, play, pray, live, learn, lead, love, work. All right. So like right.
Your mind is just a series of lists. I wish people could see you're not reading off a list. You're just, you have this in your head.
But it totally.
I'm still writing down the thing about people.
Oh, it totally works. So sweat, play, pray, live, learn, lead, love, work. Those are your places. Okay.
Sweat, pray, play.
I'm going to make it a song.
Oh, God.
Like a rap. Like, sweat, play, pray. Live, learn, lead, love, work. Sweat, play, pray. Live, learn, lead, love, work.
First time anyone's
sweat,
rapping play, on the Saturday Night Special, that's for sure.
It is a horror. Sweat, pray, pray. Live, learn, lead, love, work. Yo. I put the yo. My kids are going to be embarrassed about the yo. So anyway, so those are the places.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, that's where I put myself. And if you're home alone or if you're not going out and if you're not putting yourself in places where you're around people, then you're going to get the same results.
And that can be a range of things. I mean, you gave a romantic example, but professionally, that's a networking event. That's a
totally
taking a class. Right. That's going back to school to get a master's. I mean, that could be a lot of things.
Absolutely. And professionally, it is going to, you know, professionally, it could also be virtual, you know, going on LinkedIn and liking someone's profile and following them, or going on Twitter and having some type of engagement, or going to some meetup. Because the beautiful thing now is anything I want, there are always places I can go no matter where I am in the world. And there are people I can connect with. And sooner rather than later, I'm going to be in physical rooms with these people. My whole thing is, it's not about asking people for anything. It's about aligning yourself. Mm. Life is about aligning. Because when we're asking, what we're doing is saying, if you say no, I'm going to be devastated or hurt. And, you know, I'm going to be hurt no matter what. But they have all the power. But when it's aligning, it's I'm going to align myself. And over time, I'm going to offer an invitation, serving something up. But getting back to your self-rejection piece, if I don't think I'm good enough, and I don't think I'm worthy, then I'm only going to want people to invite me and ask me because I'm going to be too afraid.
Mm.
See, when I know I'm good enough and I'm in the right places and I surround myself with the right people, I could be patient. And patience is the hardest part because we all want it now and the pain is so real. Getting comfortable with the uncomfortable and grit and resilience, it's all about having the ability to tolerate the time it takes to find your people and places and get where you want to go. And that's so hard. While sober. Okay.
Right.
And that's the
not medicating yourself
right.
anyway.
And that's the hardest part. So it's always, what do I want? What makes me uncomfortable? People, places, patience. Then it's taking action. And then the last part is celebrate, reflect, and repeat. Celebrate that you did it. What went well? What didn't go well? If you say no, celebrate. Like, I get rejected by so many people. And when they reject me, I actually say thank you. One of the ways I was syndicated.
Do people find that awkward when you say thank you to a rejection?
I mean, but it's so funny you asked me that because I'm like so used to it. I'm like, thank you for being honest. You know, even if I'm doing, I did a high school tour and I was at these high schools in the middle of Washington and I had people who didn't want to be there because who wants to be in an assembly when you're a junior
sure.
in high school? And I even said to people, I start now and I go, hey, how many of you don't want to be here? Okay. Just because I know it's like, and then they applaud and I'm like, hey, don't you better slow down applauding. And I'm like, I know you don't want to be here and I'm okay with that, but hopefully you can appreciate what I'm putting out here.
Yeah.
So it's this whole thing of celebrating. Then it's reflecting, which is that idea of being honest and having the humility. And only those who have people, places, and patience can reflect. Then it's moving forward. Now, if you think about this, this whole way of looking at life, I call it a framework, a risk-taking framework. It has nothing to do with you saying yes or no as much as it being successful. Okay, success isn't determined by yes or no. Success is determined by the act of experiencing and processing what happens next. And when you look at life from that point of view, there isn't as much risk. Because what's the worst thing that's going to happen? You're going to say no. And when you say no, I could say, thank you. I'm just curious why.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, you know, if we were taking calls, it's when do I say why? You know, I've been ghosted or I apply for a job and people don't give me the job. The way that I became a syndicated advice columnist is when I graduated from college, I sent media kits to everyone. And I got rejected from everyone, including people in the Tribune Syndicate.
Mm-hmm.
And every time people rejected me, I would call them up and thank them. And I said, I said, my name is Harlan Cohn, and I really I'm so grateful that you reviewed my application, my columns. You know, I just want to know what is it that I could do in the future to be a part of your organization? And I ended up having lunches with the syndicate director in New York. I had meals here with the people at Tribune. And it was this idea of, it's not about yes or no. It's just about aligning myself with people who I genuinely respect and want to get to know. That's also, like, I'm so excited to meet you. I think you're such a wonderful, bright light in Chicago who does such amazing things. Not
Thank
only
you.
For, you know, I can see you put your head on. You don't like to hear that. You know, but
I appreciate it though. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that's the whole piece. So for those of you who are like rejection, you know, it's no. Rejection is just that thing that you need to be able to tolerate to get where you want to go. but it's not the thing that should ever stop you. But the only way you can face it is if you acknowledge, and this is the most important piece of this, okay, this thing I call the universal rejection truth. Okay.
Oh, that sounds like a religion. What do we do?
No, I'm not, just send your money.
Yeah.
Okay. No, the universal rejection truth is the most powerful force of the universe, at least that I've seen and recognized in my life and other people's lives. The universal rejection truth says not everyone and everything is going to respond to me the way I want everyone and everything to respond. Okay.
We're not going to be everyone's cup of tea.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we hear it in so many ways and there's so many cliches, but mm-hmm. here, the reality is there's this truth. And there are two types of people. There are those who fight the truth and those who face the truth. Those who fight it are always hating, hiding, and blaming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And we all know people that do that so much.
Oh, my gosh. And then here's the tricky part. You know, like, I'm great at rejection, but there's those five areas. SEPFA, remember? Social, emotional, physical, financial, and academic. I may be good and be able to embrace the universal rejection truth in one area of my life, but in another, I might be totally unable to face it. Mm-hmm. Which is fascinating because, and then we tend to just lean on those strengths where we can be incredibly successful in business, but yet in our emotional life and our social life, we may not be able to face it.
We may be a hot mess.
Right. And then if you work with certain people who rise through the ranks, when it comes to management, they don't train us on how to handle rejection and help our community members to face the uncomfortable. You can rise through the ranks and you can be terrible at hearing the truth. Yeah. And you can be awful at sharing the truth because the truth isn't something that's part of training in life. It's more about the destination. So embracing this truth is so important. Those who face the truth are able to look at opportunities in that light of I'm offering an invitation. I want to align myself. And they're able to move forward with confidence and clarity. But you know what? They get beat up.
Sure.
I'm so beaten and bruised. I mean, and I'm embarrassed even about some of the things I said tonight. I am because I was vulnerable.
I mean, maybe the rep. No, I'm just kidding.
The rep. That wasn't the part. Now I'm upset about
no,
that.
No, it's all good.
No, but I have people at home who will support me and other people. So, I mean.
I even wonder, too, as you're talking about areas in that, you know, social, emotional, physical, financial, academic / professional, in that realm of those five areas where, you know, where there's high risk and reward attached to it there. Even the steps that you go through of, okay, you've got, you know, look at the people that you want to surround yourself with, the places where you want to do these things, the timeline, all of these things. Even as you're going through that, I imagine as people are taking themselves through that mentally in those areas of their life, there's probably different sticking points for different people and in different aspects.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's the part where we have to acknowledge what is it that's really our sticking point. So if I were to look at my weight, okay, a lot of people deal with weight. You know, as a man, I don't hear a lot of men talking about.
A lot of women do often.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say there's a lot of socialization that encourages us to talk about that as women constantly.
Yeah. And for men, there's
not so much.
There's very little.
Yeah.
But if I were to say, what's my sticking point is, you know, it's emotional. For me, it's emotional. And if I really want to create change as opposed to pretending I want to create change, mm-hmm. then I need to really enlist people. I need to find people who are experts who can help me to look at why is it emotionally I struggle. And why is it that after 2 weeks, I go back to that crutch? And I've examined myself and going from the age of 13, when I was a Weight Watchers dropout, you know, never thinking I was worthy of finding a date. You know, my freshman year, someone telling me I was too fat to date, to my senior year being the most in love I've ever been. You know, I still had a brain of a fat person. And even saying the word fat, like I have to pause when I say fat, because to me, fat is the worst 4-letter word in the world. And it's 3. Right. How about that? But that's scary. So the sticking point, it's you have to be brutally honest. But here's the other part, Amy, is that some of us aren't equipped. So if you're like in a small town and you are gay and you have no people and you have no places, it's going to be really hard for you to be able to take that risk because you don't have the dynamics in place to handle it. So you need to make sure before you take that risk that you have your people, the right people, and you have your places, whether they're virtual or real. And then for those people who have those sticking points, it's saying, okay, instead of doing things the way I've done it in the past, I'm going to find different people and I'm going to find different places. And I know people listening are probably thinking, you know, I've done this before, I've done that. But, you know, I'm annoying because I can always offer 5 more ways to do it. But
well, you touch on something just now that I think is really interesting that I want to explore a little bit. And that is, as we're pushing ourselves to be uncomfortable, even begrudgingly or even you know, if we know it's best and know it's something we want and aren't sure how to do it, I think there is an interesting consideration there of kind of a line of safety or toxicity of people and controlling other people's reactions. I think that's a weird one, but I want to take a break. When we come back, I want to look at that because that to me is sort of a line I think we have to consider as we're pushing ourselves into uncomfortable places and into vulnerability. So we will be right back in just a bit. We're talking with author and advice columnist Harlan Cohen, and we're talking all about rejection tonight. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. This is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with us. We are talking, as ever, we pick one big topic and talk about it all evening long. And that topic tonight is rejection. So we have Harlan Cohen, not Carlin Hohen. I'm sorry.
I can't believe you even know that that was my other name. I thought that was all deleted from the internet.
Nope, I found it.
Horrified.
Reporter skills right there. Anyway, we have Harlan Cohen, best-selling author and advice columnist here in studio with us tonight because he has made a career out of helping people be very comfortable with being uncomfortable. And so we've been talking about so much as ever when we kind of scratch the surface on these topics that we pick. There's so much there and there's perhaps even more there than I imagined there would be there. There's so much. But right before the break, and we're going to get you to news here in just a couple minutes. But right before the break, we touched on something that I really want to think about. And that is we put a lot of thought into, and I think the popular narrative anyway is very much like, hey, just go for it. Go do the thing. Force yourself into this space. And as we're talking about rejection as something that could be like kind of a mental power tool, you've talked about some really great ways to break it down and just kind of make a list of things to do to tackle it. But I wonder too about where the line is for your own safety, where your own, you know, I mean, fear on some level mostly stops us, and keeps us in our comfort zone, but sometimes fear is protecting us from things that are legitimately a threat. So, you know, if it's something where you might, you know, how do you manage that, right? How do you kind of, where do you draw the line between this is something I need to do even though I am fearful versus this might actually put me in a bad spot?
Absolutely. I mean, talking to that coworker and asking them on a date when you're violating the sexual harassment policy.
Right.
That's a bad risk.
Sure.
Okay?
Don't do that.
Right. That's not what I'm saying. When you're concerned and there's fear, again, what do I want? I want to do something. I want to, you know, I want to talk to someone about something. I want something. What makes me uncomfortable? Well, there's this fear. There's this deeper fear of my safety and well-being, whether it's financial, whether it's emotional. Then it's always that people, places, patience. Mm-hmm. That framework really works. So it's who are my people? And those who struggle the most have no people or the wrong people. Okay. There are a lot of people who have toxic friends.
Yeah.
You know who those people are. They're the ones who are stuck in a state of rejection, denying this truth, always hating, hiding, and blaming, and pulling you along. And there was a point in my life where I had to do some friend restructuring, and I pretty much started over.
I like how you said friend restructuring, like it's layoffs or something.
It was a friend. They got notes. No, I slowly distanced myself, and I put myself in different places. I got real involved with the improv community here. Improv Olympic was a wonderful place where I met some really incredible people. And I also then reconnected with some other friends. And I did it with intention so that I was surrounded by the right people who I can trust so that when I'm unsure, they're going to help me. You know, I'm so lucky. I have wonderful parents. You know, my father is a rock. My mother is a rock. My brothers are my best friends. My wife as well. I mean, I have just there five people, and my in-laws even. So your people, that's where you're able to be able to determine, is this a risk? And then with those people, you can walk through the scenario of, after I do take this risk, am I going to be okay? Because here's the secret. If you know you're going to be okay no matter what, you can always listen to your heart.
Fair enough. I like even just saying, after doing this, am I going to be okay? I think that's a good, you know, gut check of, I might be upset, but am I going to be safe and reasonably, you know, okay? I think that's an important point. So we're going to take a quick break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and still so much to talk about when we're talking about this big topic of rejection. Plus, we have a couple of other people we're going to be talking to about this topic, too. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Ow. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Huth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for being with us tonight. As ever, grateful to you for sharing part of your weekend with me. We're talking all about rejection tonight, and that is a topic leading up to the week, or leading up to this show. As I was telling people throughout the week what the show was going to be about, people would go, ooh, because people kind of cringe on that topic. But nonetheless, there's a lot to it. And we have Harlan Cohen in studio with us. He is a best-selling author and advice columnist who has talked a whole lot about rejection in his career, because it is something that comes up a lot for all of us, and power and just runs through everything we do, powers a lot of our decisions for better or worse. So we've been talking a little bit about how we can maybe shift rejection into something we might actually embrace to try to, you know, widen our horizons a little bit, something like that, get outside of our comfort zones, get the things we want. Really, that's what it's about. And so we welcome now to the program by phone, professor and co-author of a study about how language helps or hurts our shot at our goals. Please welcome Vanessa Patrick from the University of Houston. Hi, Vanessa. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. Well, so I have so many questions about your work, but in particular, in the work I Don't versus I Can't, When Empowered Refusal Motivates Goal-Directed Behavior. That's from Oxford University Press. It is really widely cited. A lot of people have pointed to this as really kind of a lot about self-talk. And so kind of talk us through this a little bit about how your work talks about language as how it impacts our ability to accomplish the goals that we set.
Right. So this work really is about self-talk and the power that language has in framing refusal. Now, we know that saying no is really difficult for us. And being able to say no effectively is a real challenge. And so the work was motivated by this idea of empowered refusal, which is to be able to say no effectively. What we identified in this work are just simple words. And by adopting these words, we can actually make our refusal more effective. And so the words we looked at were I don't versus I can't. And we came up with the psychological mechanism that underlies these words and how saying them actually affects you as a person and also affects people who you say them to. So, for example, we argue that saying I don't is a very empowered phrase. It really suggests that you are in the driver's seat. It's about being in control. It's about being decisive. It's about being determined. And it signals that. It also says, this is who I am. This is my personal policy. So this research is really part of a larger stream of work that I've done on personal policies.
Well, it is really...
In contrast...
Sorry, go ahead. No, I didn't mean to cut you off.
In contrast, saying I can't really signals that you're not in control, that it's external forces that are affecting how you are making your decisions. And it really signals deprivation and a loss of control and helplessness. And so we just, we look at empowered refusal using don't versus can't in terms of both self-talk, which is the paper you referred to, but also in communicating your decisions to others, which is another paper that is uses the same words but actually talks about how you refuse others.
So essentially you're saying it's more, you're coming from a more empowered place to say, I don't eat two bags of Doritos every single night as opposed to I can't, right? That you're going to then say, this is my policy and this is something I'm choosing as opposed to I can't because I just can't. So
right. And so my personal policies model really says you have to identify your values and your priorities, and then you need to act on them and set them such and communicate them in a way that's actually empowered.
And so when you shift that a little bit, when it's less about, because I'm I'm thinking, you know, and I've seen this work cited a lot in health and wellness as opposed to like at making healthy choices. But where, when we shift this into maybe going for a goal or not letting fear stop us from doing something, where, how does that play into that?
Absolutely. I think that that it's really about, and if it looks more broadly of the words I don't versus I can't, being able to communicate a personal policy. So if your personal policy is related to a goal, either it could be a habit that you want to break or a good thing that you want to start doing or a project you want to start working on, it's really about deciding what policy needs to be put in place and then communicating that policy.
So if you're going to apply that to a big goal, how would you word that in your thinking to yourself? I can't procrastinate on this big project, or I don't. How does that go?
Exactly. So, you know, I've got over the years, I've gathered many examples of very effective people who do this really well. So, for example, one of my favorite authors, Isabel Allende, she has a personal policy. She basically says that I start writing on Jan 8. I don't accept speaking arrangements. I don't entertain. I don't do certain things because writing is my priority after Jan 8th of a year. It's really about setting those policies and putting them in place and then communicating them when it has to do with other people, but also communicating them to ourselves.
Right.
I think that. Hi, this is Harlan. It's wonderful to speak with you, and I think your work is phenomenal and incredibly helpful. I do a lot of work with teenagers, and this idea of don't and can't, I could see that coming up, especially with students who are going to college for the first time, and they're trying to make new friends, and someone offers them a drink, and a personal policy that governs their behaviors, and then the other part is, but also communicates why this is important to me, as opposed to I don't drink, but then the rest of it, the why part. And my question is, when you say the don't, is explaining the why, is that also part of it?
I think that what we've shown in our work is that when you say I don't, especially to other people, it signals that this is part of your identity and it signals a sense of conviction. So for example, let's say you're a vegan. If you're a vegan, you don't eat dairy and you don't eat meat. You just say that and nobody challenges it because that's what you do. You're a vegan, right? And if you don't drink, you don't really need an extra explanation for that. It's a very empowering statement because it really doesn't require the because. What we've shown in our work is that can't requires a because. As soon as you say, I can't, it almost begs the question, why?
Well, that's interesting. I was thinking of the example of an emotional risk, like someone who wants to kiss someone on a first date. You could say, you know, someone leans in for the kiss and the person who's on the receiving end says, I don't kiss on a first date. Now the person that person who's being rejected is going to be like, I'm never calling that person again. I'm ugly. I'm disgusting. I'm awful. As opposed to, I don't kiss on a first date. But let me tell you, you are so kissable, and I can't wait for the second date.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's you hit the nail on the head in terms of the fact that you're switching things from being a rejection to being a personal policy. As soon as you say I don't, it's not about rejecting the other person. It's about exerting a personal policy, and you switch the dynamic. Because I don't kiss on a first date essentially is saying it's not about you, it's about me, it's about my personal policy. And when the right time comes, it will happen.
Right. And so how do we take the steps to start shifting internal dialogue like that? If you're, you know, maybe you're really entrenched in the habit of, you know, I can't, or you're really trying to make a shift to saying don't as opposed to can't. Are there steps to take to kind of make that transition a little smoother? Or
Absolutely.
Is it just about deciding?
No, it's really about self-reflection, and this speaks to the broader scheme of my work, which really is about, you know, self-knowledge is the key to self-leadership. So if you want to essentially take yourself either in your organization or at a personal level, if you want to enhance your life and gain personal mastery, the first thing you need is kind of an assessment of yourself and what you care about. And as soon as you identify those priorities and set those priorities for yourself, that's when you need to figure out what are some of the personal policies that come into place. And of course, this is just one of them that you could argue is a good, more linguistic-based cue that allows you to say very simply, hey, this is one way in which we know we can resist temptation, or this is one way in which we know that we are going to be able to communicate where we stand to others.
Is there a place where you, it seems like, as I said before, this gets, your work is cited a lot in health and wellness and things that kind of speak to, you know, discipline around healthy choices. Are there other areas where you see this particularly applicable? I'm thinking of maybe addiction and recovery, things like that.
So I actually haven't done any work on addiction and recovery per se, so I can't speak to that. I suspect it might work. We have done work on communicating refusal to others. So, for example, let's say you're on a diet and you don't want to eat the chocolate cake at a party, but your boss's wife is insisting that you do. How do you actually say no to her? And one of the ways in which you can do it is to actually use these specific words. I don't eat chocolate cake. Immediately you shut down the pressure that someone else is putting on you. We've done this really cool study, which really was a role play kind of study, in which, you know, you have somebody trying to sell another person a magazine subscription, and that person is trying their best to sell the magazine subscription. And the people who were trained to either say I don't versus I can't buy that magazine subscription, and it turned out that the person who was selling the magazine subscription was much more willing to let the sales pitch go and to kind of not push any further when the person actually said, hey, I don't do this, I don't make decisions on the fly. I never make a magazine subscription decision without consulting somebody. Whatever the conviction statement was, it was much more effective if you came from an empowered place and when you communicated to others that, hey, I'm in the driver's seat here. And when I say this, I mean it.
I think that was a really interesting way that you outlined that the don't doesn't require a because, whereas the can't almost begs for one. And I'm thinking of if someone were to say, I don't drink, you probably wouldn't question that. You might think, oh, that's probably super personal reasons, I don't want to know, versus I can't. Are you allergic to alcohol? What's the deal? Right. It seems like right away you would want to say what the because is.
Then the part though that I think about is if I say I don't do something, then I'm worried about what you think. You know, there's always those people who say, I don't do this. Now someone's going to think that I'm rude. If I don't eat cake, you know, I'm in the boss. I don't eat chocolate. It's like, well, who are you? You know, everyone likes chocolate. Ew, goodbye. And, you know, this job's over. Does that ever come up of like, you know, how do people respond to the don't versus the can't as opposed to the person who's articulating that?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. We haven't actually looked at whether there are any negative repercussions. We've only looked at whether people get pushback. I mean, I'm sure that there are boundaries to the utility of this effect, but in general, it's really about conveying conviction, and most often these situations are so benign that it really doesn't matter. And, you know, you just say, hey, I don't do this. And people say, okay, fine, you know, okay, you don't do it. And it's really about conveying where you stand. And what we've shown is that when it comes from that, it's almost like you're saying that this is who I am. This is my identity. And very few people actually challenge that identity. They might not like it in the longer run, but they don't challenge it. And as far as you're concerned, the goal is met.
Right. Very interesting. A lot to think about there with personal policies. I think we could all learn a lot from your work. Thank you so much, Dr. Vanessa Patrick from University of Houston, for sharing your knowledge with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, we are going to take a little break. We'll be right back in just a bit to continue this conversation all about rejection, the way we talk to each other and to ourselves. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight and sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. Always very grateful to you for that. We have in studio with us this evening Harlan Cohen. He is an author. He's a best-selling author, in fact, and an advice columnist. And he has done a whole lot of work and thought around this topic tonight that we are exploring, and that is rejection. We were just talking with a professor, Dr. Vanessa Patrick from University of Houston, before the break, who did all this work around the way we talk to ourselves influences the outcome. In particular, she was looking at I don't versus I can't, which I think was really interesting, Harlan, about kind of this idea of setting a personal policy. And I'm curious how that language, I mean, you've done so much work in this area and thought so much that you have created so many lists in your brain that we've seen tonight that are so interesting, but also very helpful to kind of help us work through these things, to kind of troubleshoot rejection and make it kind of a tool. Where does, in your mind, where does language, particularly the language we use on ourselves, mm-hmm. play into all of this?
So my take is I tell stories, and instead of looking at it as language, because to me it gets too, you know, it's too much minutia, too finite.
Sure.
It's always a story, and every day we tell ourselves stories, and after every interaction we tell ourselves stories. Just like when I leave the studio tonight, I'm going to tell myself the story of my time visiting with you and everyone else.
That's an interesting way to put that, because how often do you leave a room and you go, "That was awesome. That was awesome" as a story?
Yeah.
Even those little things, if you think
short
of them
story.
As stories.
It's a short, very short story. Almost shorter than a haiku.
Definitely shorter than a haiku.
Very short. Or just awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. But really, we tell ourselves these stories. So what is the story we tell ourselves? Well, when I talked about, you know, me looking in the mirror, being a little bit heavier than I want to be, the story is either, ugh, you know, what the hell happened to you? How did you do this to yourself? You're back where you are again. Or the story is, oh my gosh, look at you. I'm so proud of you and what you're doing and how hard you're working. And I know where you're going, and I can't wait to see you change and reflect exactly who you know you are.
But how do you, if you're really, you know, say disappointed in the way something worked out, say you have been super rejected about something and you're trying to give yourself this kind of positive talk, where, you know, where do you land in that when it's like you feel defeated about it?
So let's, I'm going to stop.
Okay.
Because I'm too happy and positive. Seriously. Like I'm rejection. Yeah, it's great. Rejection sucks.
Sure.
It's awful. It's terrible. So Definitely. Here's the thing. You give yourself 24 hours to just be a lump, just a lumpishka. That's what I call it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, you just, and you can beat yourself up. Because it's irrational to say, I'm only going to give myself positive self-talk. That's phooey.
Yeah.
But what you do is you give yourself a timeline. And I say, and this is what I say to my wife, I'm going to beat myself up for 12 hours. Okay, just give me 12 hours. And that 12 hours is filled of would've, should've, could've, all those things. And then I set a time. And after that time, I have to tell a different story. And if you can't tell a different story, this is where you employ your people. This is where mental health experts are wonderful, because you can emotionally vomit on them. And if you get stuck, and sometimes we get stuck not just because we are telling the wrong story. We've been conditioned for our whole life. We may have issues that need medication and need more help. And this is where, if I'm telling the same story all the time and I'm getting the same results all the time, well, you know what? This hour on the radio is not going to really do anything for me. But what it's going to do is get me to a place to think, why do I keep telling the same story? And who is the person? And we start with one person. And it's always easier to start with someone I can hire to help. And if we don't have money, then we go to a spiritual leader. Because God is always there. Even if you don't like God, don't have a good relationship with God, God's there. People will listen. You get free food a lot of times. It's really wonderful. So you find those people, and that's how you break that cycle. So you find hope. One of the things I love to do, and I'm working on a new project on rejection, and what I'm doing is working with people who have been through the darkness and found the light. Because there's proof that says, there's this wonderful book called The Power of Habit. And it's a wonderful audiobook. I listen to audiobooks because I have a hard time reading and I'm an author, which is shameful. But The Power of Habit's wonderful because it talks about when you want to make a change and you go back to your old habits, especially when it comes to addiction, if you have people in your corner, which is so important for recovery programs, having people will help you from relapsing. It'll keep you from relapsing and going back to those old habits. So in order to change these habits, which is what we, the story is a habit.
Sure.
We then can recognize that I don't like this habit. And then I can reach out to those people to tell a different story. And even walking in going, I want to tell a different story. And they're going, what's the story you tell?
And like gut checking that with your people.
Yeah.
And
then this part of vulnerability, and the doctor mentioned this as well. One way I like to look at it is you could stand in front of a mirror, and I call it wearing a thong. Okay. So it's a Saturday night, right? It's like, where did that come from? But I figure, you know what? Let's keep this fun. Let's keep this going. So let's bring out the thong. Okay. So what you do is you stand in front of a mirror wearing a thong, a physical thong. Okay.
And for men, emotional thong.
Or an emotional thong. But you get that thong super tight and you lock the door. Okay. And you look in the mirror. Okay. And you do it for 15 minutes because a minute's just shocking. 15 minutes, you start to settle down. You're like, wow, look at my thong. And you couldn't do it naked. Because if you do it naked, it's like, oh, that's beautiful. I'm beautiful. But when you're in a thong, things are pulling over, hanging over, and very tight underwear for men or women, whatever. So you look in the mirror. And I did this. I actually did this when I was single. I did it on Clark Street in tight underwear. My wife's going to kill me. I was in these tidy whities. And I was so like disgusted with myself. And I stood in front of the mirror in my white tidy whities. And I said, and I looked and I said, here's what I want to change. I acknowledged what was hanging out of my thong, physical, emotional, spiritual. Those are the thongs. Okay. So when we want to make a change and we're uncomfortable, you look in the mirror. You like the thong? You like the thong?
Esteemed producer Tom Hush is like having a fit right now.
Because I'm talking about thongs?
You're all good. It's okay to say thong on the radio.
This is family.
No, it's we're cracking up.
Right. But if you think of it, it's being vulnerable,
certainly,
which I know you like to spend a lot of time with.
Certainly.
And what's more vulnerable than that? But you put on an emotional thong. And putting on an emotional thong means I'm going to look through that darkness. And when I told you about the people who I'm interviewing,
yeah,
it's people who have been through that darkness, who have faced the horrible truth and have seen the light and have come through it. Because those of us who have been there and have faced it and been able to work through it, survivors, those who have been there and done it, that's empowerment. That's the people
and
who
probably
are
have a much by. You know, richer and more in-depth perspective on what it is, really.
Absolutely.
There's a lot there. As always, we pick these big topics, start unpacking them, and all these things are there for us to explore and look at. We are talking all about rejection tonight, and clearly we're realizing how much it intersects with vulnerability and risk and all these other things that are sometimes also very, very difficult. So let us take a quick break and get you to news, all the good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We have been talking about so many things tonight with this topic of rejection. That is the big topic tonight. And you would not think that we would be having so much fun talking about this topic, but nonetheless, we are. We have Harlan Cohen in studio with us, best-selling author and advice columnist, who has been thinking about rejection much harder than anyone I know, possibly, and breaking it down for us. And we've been thinking about lots of different aspects to it. We are joined now on the phone by Siobhan Kukulik, and she is an author. She's based in Toronto, and she's an author who has really, really embraced rejection. Siobhan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Amy. Yes, rejection has been a way of life, and I'm so happy I held on to my dream and kind of got to the other side.
I'm delighted to read your bio. It is such an interesting, the bio that you have on your site is so interesting because you've done so many things, and thinking about it through the lens of seeking out rejection, it seems like you have done that so many times to such a wonderful result. But I want to start with your goal of getting 100 rejection letters on the path to getting your book published.
Yes. So in the year 2000, I decided I wanted to become a published author. And so I made a goal of 100 rejection letters because Dr. Seuss got 43 for his first story. And I thought, you know, he had some success, so I'll go higher than his goal. And every time I got a rejection letter, it was a win. And, you know, instead of it being a pity party, it was, okay, I'm one step closer to my goal. So over the years, I did multiple manuscripts, and I had 32 rejections for different children's book stories and things like that. And then finally, in the year 2016, January 1st, I thought, you know what, I'm going to start a blog, and I'm just going to start sharing my writing and my thoughts that way. And about 4 months into that, in April 2016, I was accepted as a Huffington Post contributor. So that kind of gave me some energy and, you know, got my mojo going. And then throughout that year, I started thinking more and more about publishing, and I ended up deciding to publish the first year into a blog at the end of that year, and this is the Treasure You Seek book that's now on Amazon and Indigo as of last week, and it's just been such a great journey, and the rejection is really, you know, the way I got there is through accepting rejection and never giving up.
I love that. So why 100? If Dr. Seuss got 43, why not 44 or 86? Why 100?
I just thought, you know, 100 seems like a good round number, 10 sets of 10, and it seemed like such a lofty goal. I thought, you know, I'm never going to give up because it's going to be a long road to get to 100 rejections. And I just thought I'll keep going through it. And I really feel, you know, I'm a mother of three kids, 14, 12, and 9, and I feel like in this day and age with kind of mental wellness and your thoughts become things and you become what you believe. And I really feel that if I could give a message to, you know, graduates from high school or graduates from university, I would tell them the one thing you know for sure is that you're going to fail. Everybody, adults, children. And if you accept that and embrace it, I mean, the sky's the limit. That's what stops so many people is that they take it so personally, but it's not about them. It's just the moment or the person, or they're not looking for that. It's nothing to do with you. You know, as Don Miguel Ruiz said in the Four Agreements, what other people think of you is none of your business. So if you can embrace that and move forward, your dreams will come true. That's kind of what I've always believed.
So it's Harlan here, and congratulations on all your rejections.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. So two questions. One is,
yes,
what was the most painful? And this is the part where I know, as someone who's been rejected so many times, that even though we kind of compartmentalize, it can still hurt. And in that, what hurt? Tell me about that pain.
Well, I think that, you know, I've been doing this now for, I've been a writer. I'm a, by trade, I'm a freelance copywriter where I, you know, write advertising pieces. And I remember getting a piece of advice at the very beginning of my career, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors, fake it till you make it. And you have to just kind of keep going. You don't always think you know all the answers and you don't even know all the questions. Just kind of go forward. But initially, the first few years, you do take it personally. If you, you know, because writing especially comes right from the soul. And it's like, this is my heart that I'm putting out on the paper. And so, yes, there were definitely times early on that I kind of thought, well, why wouldn't they like that? And why isn't that good enough? And am I not good enough?
Did you cry? Like, tell me about the time you cried.
No, I think I definitely took it personally, you know, at the beginning and thought, you know, why is this not being accepted? But then I realized, I mean, you have to get through. I started reading. This is what got to me to the parts of the book as well. I started reading about all these famous failures. I mean, things like, you know, I love the Sylvester Stallone story that he's, you know, a down and out actor. He has no money in his bank account and he spends 3 days writing the script for Rocky. And then he shops it around. He's got no money. And finally, somebody says, we'll give you $350,000 for the script, which is millions of dollars, you know, based on this day and age. And he still says, but I want to star in it. I thought, wow, here's this guy that he's starving. He's got no money in the bank. And he fought for that dream. And it goes on to 10 Oscar nods, all kinds of awards. You know, I think he just, you know, on the top 100 list of films of all time from a guy writing a film in 3 days. And it made his career. And I just think that it was stories like that that told me, what am I crying about? I mean, everybody's got a story. And if you can accept that failure and go on, you're going to get there too. So, you know, there is pain for sure, but you have to walk through the pain because, you know, as I say in my book, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek, as Joseph Campbell said. So you've got to have fear to get through it.
I love the detail of that story. I love the most is that he didn't just sell it. He sold it and said, and I want to star in it.
It
wasn't
like,
about,
you gotta believe.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for asking big and just having the chutzpah to just go and do it and ask and get. I think that's really interesting.
100%.
But that seems to be something that has echoed through your life a lot. In particular, I don't even know where to start next because you did the Peace Garden and you got all these trees donated. You crowdfunded over $100,000 in 2 weeks to pay for an unfunded drug to try to save a woman's life. You had drug policy change. You've done all these things. And is that the same approach that you've taken in those endeavors as with this of just, I'm just going to push forward?
Definitely. Like with those two stories there, they were people I didn't even know very well, but I heard the stories and I just thought there, but for the grace of God, go I. One woman was a mother of two. She was 40 years old. She had been given 2 months to live with brain cancer. And there was a drug available in three other provinces in our country, but not in our province, that she could have gotten covered, but it wasn't covered first. It was $4,400 every 2 weeks. Her kids were making bracelets and, I mean, bake sales. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, so I just started emailing all these reporters and sharing the story and telling the reporters she's going down to talk to the, you know, the healthcare minister. She's going, and they said, what, where? And I'm giving address. I'm sitting at home eating scrambled eggs in my yoga pants, sending all the reporters down. And the story became so big and the public were sitting there going, wait, let's help this woman. And so I just think people are so good. And if you put the story out there, everybody kind of rises to the occasion. And so $105,000 was raised in 2 weeks. And she was able to live 6 months longer on that drug, which was a gift to her family. And I just thought I just felt like if you don't try, you don't know. They didn't have the strength at that point. They were so busy trying to stay healthy and alive. So I just kind of shared that story. And then the other one was a little girl that had cystic fibrosis that her drug was $380,000 a year and it was not covered. And again, they had some coverage through the dad's work, but they were, again, spending $6,000 a month or something. So I started, again, sharing the story with reporters. And it got to the point that it was an hour before our provincial election. And the premier announced that Maddie would get her drug because I don't think they wanted it tabled. And again, it's just the David and Goliath story that, you know, that's one story in a media sense, but it could be happening in your local community, at your school board, in your neighborhood. You're that one voice. So if you share your story and say it from the heart, you can change the world. You can make change. And that's kind of what I tell my kids. And I think we can all do that.
So these are huge successes. I mean, incredible work. But there are people who have that same passion and they put it out there and it falls on deaf ears. Did you do this a couple times and it didn't become something so great, or does everything you do turn out to be extraordinary?
No, I definitely do not have like a magic touch or anything, but I think that there were times I went and made some deputations at the school board talking about the importance of the arts and physical education. And I gave them some free ideas of things that they could work on. And it just was, you know, nothing that came of it. And I kind of thought, well, you know, can't I get something to happen here? But you realize that in a lot of these endeavors, you have to push through different layers and try different things. And so you are going to have failures. And again, like talking to people like Walt Disney, I mean, he was fired from his first job for having no imagination. I mean, who was that boss? You know, and he kept going. And so I thought, if he has those kind of failures, I'm going to have them too. We all are. And you keep going. So yes, definitely not everything is a perfect success. But I think that there's levels of success. And I think that me sharing that deputation at the school board, it didn't necessarily make change, but because I shared it in my network, it got a discussion going and people were talking about it. So maybe there were some changes at some schools that were on a smaller level.
To me, that's the thing, is those people who you got to meet when there was a bigger issue, who you can reach out to again and again. And even though the first one didn't have the impact that you might have wanted it to have, because you had that relationship, the bigger ones came about. And that's that part of, you know, celebrating that we all share. Those of us who are great at rejection, we celebrate the experience of sharing, which you're wonderful at doing.
Oh, thank you so much. I agree 100% with you. I think that life is the journey, not the destination. And you never know who you're going to meet around the corner. And then you might cross paths again in 6 months and be like, wow, there was a reason we met. So be open to new people, new discussions. And I've always said my favorite thing is if I meet somebody and they have the complete opposite opinion of me, and at the end of the coffee or the dinner, I actually think, wow, I'm kind of believing what they're believing now. Like, I like a discussion. I like
She's from Canada.
Kind of...
Well, this is not...
I do definitely. Listen, I won't get into politics, but I do like a discussion where, help me change my mind. Give me a reason to see your side. I want to, because life is about growth, not about, I feel like the more I know, the less I know. You know, as I go through life, I'm always finding out new things. And the last thing I think is that I know the answers.
Yeah, I hear that very much. I really identify with that. I mean, I think what I'm hearing so much here is about continual expansion and of just keeping momentum, really. So how do you personally keep motivation when you are experiencing that rejection, particularly when we're, if we back up to the 100 rejections of as a writer, How do you stay motivated when, especially when some of them really hurt? I mean, all three of us are published authors, so we all know what those say. And I mean, I had one that said, if you ever write another word, you are doing a disservice as a human being. You should never write or communicate ever.
Gutting. My God. Well, that says more about that person than it does about you. That says more about them than it does about you. But I know what you mean.
Person.
I think, yeah, exactly. I think that I definitely took opportunities when I had unpublished work. Like, my message has always been about kind of grit and perseverance and embracing failure. So I've taken opportunities to speak in classrooms of kids if I know the teacher and kind of share. And sometimes, like, I went into one recently and I kind of thought, well, are these, you know, 15-year-old kids really going to be into this message? And at the end, I was saying things to them like, you know, if you love animals, volunteer at a vet clinic. If you love politics, volunteer at a campaign. Do it now when you have no responsibilities and you can kind of go out and learn. And there was all these kids that came up to me after and asked questions and said, well, who do I ask for and what should I do? And I thought, you know, I'm spreading my message. At this point, it wasn't published yet. It wasn't something that was published, but it made me feel like I was making a difference. So I think you have to not always gauge your success as this finish line of, you know, whatever you decide it's going to be, that you're going to be at a certain level of notoriety, or that you kind of even getting published. Even if someone isn't published, but they've got a great message, why not share it and talk about it and get your name out there as someone who's trying to get discussions going? And you never know where it'll lead. So I think you have to always embrace your message and take it to different paths and just see where it leads you.
And I think there's something to be said for just kind of having enthusiasm and motivation generally around making asks, because sometimes really strange and weird stuff can happen as a result of putting something out into the world. Really interesting conversations can happen. I mean, I feel like that's a social experiment that happens every single day on Twitter, as you're just running into serendipity constantly with things people are talking about that interest you and they may be on the other side of the world.
Oh, I agree 100%. And you brought up the point when I did a peace garden for the school, for example. I'm all about the ask. I always ask for forgiveness, not permission. And I remember phoning up a local CEO of a company. I emailed him, actually, a cold email. I said, we're a local school. We'd like to get an eco classroom going. I've sourced the trees. They're $500 each. Would you consider buying one? So it's a very specific ask. I'm asking for one tree, $500. Would he consider investing in a local community school? And he said, I'll buy three. So then I went back and I found out one of the dads at the school was a landscaper, and he said, I can get the tree for $300. So I went back to the CEO and said, the trees are $300 now, so that will just be $900 instead of $1,500. He said, you know what, I'll take five trees. So in that one cold email, I got the tree, the five, you know, 20-foot maples for the school. If I had thought, oh, I can't ask that, that's, you know, there's no policy for that. There's no process. How can I? You just go out and make a specific ask, and what's the worst that can happen? They'll say no. And then you go to the next person. And that's how you have to live your life. You can't be scared of rejection, because everybody's going to get rejected, you know? So you have to embrace that.
So, Siobhan, the part of the people piece, the people who are in your corner when you get beat up, when it's really, who are the three people who have been the most helpful when it comes to taking these risks and getting these results? Are you okay?
I'm just
I just want to make sure it's not you.
Okay. Fire truck is busted. They're gone now. Sorry. Hope everybody there is okay, but I'm fine. The people that have been helpful in rejection. I feel like, three people. I would say my mother, 100%, because my mother, I feel like as a child, her eyes always lit up when I came in the room. It didn't matter if I was coming home from school, coming home from Europe, coming home from university. She just always made me feel like I can do anything. It doesn't matter what you want to do, you can do it. And I think that if you have that relationship with someone, as a parent too, you know, believe me, my eyes don't always light up when you're exhausted and running around and the schedules. But I do try to tell my kids, like I say in my book, every morning when we drive to school, I say believe in, and they say it yourself. I say try your, and they say best. Choose your friends wisely. And I say that every morning to kind of remind them that they're amazing, and go out and be you. So I would say my mother for sure. My children as well have just, you know, I've learned a lot. I never thought I could learn so much from people that have been on the earth so you know, such a shorter time than I've been. They just see things clearly. They give me advice. They tell me not to sweat the small stuff. So they definitely, Jack Jameson and Maggie, and my mother, Mary Kelleher. And then I've had a lot of friends, too, who are that ear, that are constantly asking me, what are you doing with your writing? Like, you know, have you done anything? And again, because it's not a specific job where it's a 9-to-5 check in, check out, you can definitely go as a writer or whatever, you know, your side gig is and let it pass and not work on it. So those friends that constantly reminded me, like, hey, get back on that dream of yours, they just made such a huge difference. So I try to do that for other people too, and kind of remind them that they're enough. You definitely don't have to have all the answers, and you won't know all the questions. But the X factor, I believe, for all of us, no matter what we want to do, is action, because action is what will get you to the next stage.
Very much agree. Very much. Thank you so much for being with us. Unfortunately, we are sitting here watching the clock run out, so we have to dash, but we hope to speak with you again. Thank you, and good luck. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much, Amy, and so great to chat with you, and I appreciate the time, and all the best to all of you and your listeners.
Thanks so much. All right, have a great night. All right.
You too, Amy. Bye-bye.
We are going to take a little break. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we take these big old topics, we start wrestling with them, and then the show, 2 hours have gone by, and I feel like we need 7 more hours to sort out all of the stuff with it. Well, we have been hanging out with Harlan Cohen. He's been kind enough to be in studio with us all night as we have been talking about this big topic of rejection. And, you know, I've been scribbling notes the whole time, this whole show, Harlan. And really what has stuck out to me so much is about vulnerability, because that's something that comes up that I'm always looking for, is being willing to be vulnerable. But I think not just with others, but with yourself, of saying, as your, you know, your list, your checklist of things to go through, what do I want? Starting there is so powerful, because sometimes that answer can be, I don't know, because I've always done what everyone else wants me to do. So I think that's very powerful. And I think there's a lot here to wrestle with as we think about this big topic of rejection, and especially using it as kind of a guidepost or something of how to go for the things you really want. But the second beat of that I think has been interesting tonight is about all the surprises along the way. There's not just, you know, damn it, I'm just going to sell this book and be done. There's all this other stuff and people you meet along the way that I think is really interesting and really cool and powerful. Don't you think?
Oh, I love that. The journey, the adventure, the players, yeah. The people, the story. There's the beginning of the story, and then the middle of the story is the adventure. But if we know we're always going to be okay and get to a happy, bright place where we're fulfilled and feel accomplished, then we can always move forward. And it takes those right people, it takes the places, and it takes being patient, knowing we can get there. So
all of those things.
Yeah. And I want to be in people's corner. You know, I love that's why I love doing what I do, so I can be there for people along the way.
And I think that shows. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
I'm grateful to be here.